This is Take Flight with Mark Whittle.
Welcome to Take Flight. I'm Mark Whittle, former city worker turned performance coach. And this is your place for inspiration and education on ways to optimize your performance and find your purpose.
First one, past another, and into the corner goes my brother.
There's never any in-between state with me. It's like, I absolutely fucking hate him, or he's a legend or whatever.
Do you think you're a bit of that Marmite, either love him or hate him then?
100%. Yeah, I'm very different on the field than I am off. As a boy growing up, I'm very shy, introvert at heart. When I step on the field, I could be the character that I kind of wanted to be more confident, be louder, be more brash, be more aggressive. So yeah, I think I was basically playing a character.
Do you know what your void or whatever it was that like drove you and motivated you to become the great player that you were?
A lot of people talk about trauma as a big driver for successful people, and I think that was very much a case for me. And I think it comes from probably parents divorcing when I was around 10, 11, I think. Not seeing my mum since. Yeah, that was a tough moment.
Yeah.
Cabin crew, passengers, prepare for takeoff.
Mike, welcome to the Take Flight podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Mate, thanks for having me in this amazing house. It's incredible.
Yeah, I'm very lucky. Lovely area. We've only been in here a couple of years. So tried to look after my money during my playing career to allow us to be able to live where we want to live, which is this area. Good to be back from up north.
Up with the wildlings. No, mate, it's really, really nice. I love this area as well. So thanks for having me. We had a couple of bites at the cherry, didn't we?
And
yeah. I think...
Broken foot and
you rescheduled because you had something that sounds really exciting with the Brentford team or something.
Oh yeah. So I went to spend some time with Ben Ryan at Brentford, with where I want to go in my transition when that opportunity came, and he invited me down. I really wanted to get down there. He's obviously a busy man as well. So yeah, got to spend a couple of hours with him, hopefully getting there again soon.
What is his role there?
So he's head of high performance. So there's a broad spectrum of what he looks at, from how the grass is cut to the team travel to looking at their infrastructure, the new infrastructure they're building at the new training ground, make sure it's of a high performance standard, which is really interesting to me because that's, you know, what I'm passionate about, high performance, and would love to get into an elite sport in the future. So I said to him, he's kind of a flag bearer for someone like me that wants to do that and get into different sports. So I need him to go well so that, you know, more roles like that come up.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant, mate. Well, look, I've honestly been so excited to speak with you from a sporting perspective. Like, I'm sports mad, performance mad, and you're such an incredible rugby player. But also from the transitional perspective, you know, that sort of next chapter, the leap of faith, so to speak, and that taking flight into whatever's next for you. So, you know, I think there's so many things that we could talk about today. I'll try and keep it to two or three so we can keep it within the hour.
And but weirdly, we have a lot of mutual
friends
or...
acquaintances. We were already talking about Dylan there. You're saying he's a fantastic captain. You had time with him in from the under-20s up until the senior squad.
He was one of my favorite captains. I was saying to you earlier, the way he acted as that link between Eddie Jones and the players, obviously under enormous pressure as a England captain anyway, but then I can imagine behind closed doors under enormous pressure from someone as intense as Eddie, but also, you know, pressure from the players to sometimes get what we wanted, or feedback to him, stuff that he then had to take back to Eddie and we didn't have to deal with. So, a lot of admiration for the way he went about his business as England captain. But also as an England captain, you've got to deal with so much more off the field than anyone else, stakeholders and speeches after games, going to speak sponsors and people that sit on the board at the RFU. So I can't even imagine that role and what it entails and how much pressure, you know, someone like Dylan and Chris Robshaw, who was my England and Quinn's captain, would have to deal with.
Let's not beat around the bush either. Like, Dylan had a lot of like controversy and a bit of hate in the media as well that he had to deal with. So
yeah, I guess he's kind of similar sort of player in terms of his relationship with the media. I didn't have as much controversy as him, but kind of that Marmite player, you either really liked him or really didn't, and I seem to be that sort of person as well, so I can relate to him in that way. But he had a lot more controversies than me, so maybe he didn't help himself too much.
Do you think you're a bit of that Marmite, either love him or hate him then?
100%. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm very different on the field than I am off. So obviously people only see that sort of persona. But I think for me, it was very much filling a character that allowed me to get the best out of myself as a rugby player. I think I felt very early on, not even as a rugby player, but as a boy growing up, a very shy introvert, be more confident, be louder, be more brash, be more aggressive and things like that. Being a rugby player allowed me to be that sort of character once I stepped on the field. So I really enjoyed being able to do that. And then ultimately allowed me to be the best rugby player I could be, I think. So yeah, I think it was basically playing a character when I was playing rugby, which isn't a bad thing, but...
Oh, I think it's amazing, mate. I think it's so underrated, and that's why sport is just so important for people, isn't it? Because we all have those aspects of ourselves and sometimes we can't express them.
Yeah.
Some people can express it in the pub or express it in the gym or in different places, you know, but yeah, like sport does allow you to express different parts of yourself that you might not be able to elsewhere. Yeah. And if that was you being brash or whatever else, what are like, if there's like a standout moment for you when you're like, that's a good example of when I was Marmite. Like I've probably...
As a rugby player?
Yeah, I've probably divided people there.
Probably two, and both of them were in Wales.
Okay.
The first one against Wales, sorry. First one was in the World Cup, and there's that image of me, and the Welsh hate me anyway, because they probably see me as that person who epitomizes being English, I guess, shaved head, loud, aggressive, loves playing for England, really passionate, and they don't like English people really, do they, if we're honest, the Welsh, especially when it comes to rugby. So that I think they saw me as that symbol of the English team, maybe, I don't know. But yeah, I didn't get on too well with the Welsh, but there's an image of me grabbing their captain, who they absolutely love, Sam Warburton, you know, by the collars at the start of that World Cup game, because I was fired up. They were fired up, and there'd been a little ruckus breakout. So as I like to do sometimes, kind of get involved, really got me fired up. And he was kind of on the edge of it. And we'd said in the week that he was a target for us, not in a nasty, cheap shot, malicious way, but if you had a chance to put a shot on him, if you had a chance to rough him up legally, you know, he's their talisman, he's their captain. So we were going to take that opportunity, and I'm never going to get close to him most of the game because I'm at the back as a fullback, and I'm not going to be able to physically dominate him too much because he's a back row and a fullback. So this fight breaks out. I'm looking around thinking, right, this is a moment to make a statement, I guess, in terms of if the English fullback can grab the Welsh captain, number seven, talisman, and show that we're not going to back down, we're going toe-to-toe, that's our moment. So I grabbed him, and yeah, the Welsh have hammered me for that ever since. And ultimately, they went on to win, so they had the last laugh. But that happens in sport, right? So, you know, I take it on the chin, and it's all part and parcel of sport. And then the other one is... when, I'm not sure if you would have seen it, we were playing Wales at their place. It was under Stuart Lancaster. We hadn't won there for ages, I think. And there was in the tunnel, and we had that standoff. Basically, leading up to it, we knew what was going to happen. They kept doing it to teams. So basically, they would send the away team out first to have their fireworks display going off. You know, those last 5-10 minutes, and we stood there like absolute lemons in the middle of the field, watching their light show, while the crowd go nuts and, you know, we're getting cold and not ready for kickoff. So we said in the week, if this happens again, likelihood it is, we're just going to stand and wait, and we'll wait till they're ready to go out, and then we'll go out in our own time, sort of thing. So this happened. We're in the tunnel. They want us to go out so they can start their fireworks show. Their team's nowhere to be seen. And we're like, well, we're not going. We're getting ushered out by their people that are working there, the stadium manager or whoever it was, and not a chance. So we're stood there, there's this standoff. They won't come out until we've gone. But Robbo's there, quite cool, calm, collected. I'm like a raging pit bull behind him, like, we're not going anywhere. Because I'm in game mode at that point, like, you know, strolling up and down, like, we're not going anywhere. Kind of doing a talking for Robbo while he's getting heat from the event manager, trying to get him out. The referee wasn't that bothered either way. Finally, you know, we all decided to go out and they followed us out and we ended up winning. So on the flip side of the first example I gave you, we ended up winning this one. And everyone talks about that as like the defining moment, but I don't know if it is, but, you know, I think, you know, the Welsh see those two examples and yeah, they don't like me too much.
Mate, I absolutely love those examples. I love it.
Oh, I loved them both at the time because yeah. It gets you fired up. I love those sort of moments where it just gets you fired up for the game, like revved up and you're in full character mode. Yeah, I just loved it.
What are you doing in the change room before a game to get into that G'd up state? Because if you're saying you're very different off the pitch to on the pitch, like, is there a process that you go through to get yourself in that headspace?
No, not anything like banging my head against brick wall or anything. It's very, very, like I am in normal life, quite reserved, quite chilled sometimes, you know, not saying too much, going through sort of my processes of what I needed to do, which I always went through before every game. Little thoughts to myself, like, what's my first action going to be? What we said in the week about what they do? How does that relate to me? Having small conversations with people in the team.
Yeah.
You know, if you need to have, you know, like my back three, my two wingers, you know, just be aware of this. You know, if I do this, let's do that. You know, anything you need from me, things like that. Little stretches and stuff. And then I always did the same sort of things. Once I get in the change room, get kit out, I like to neat, laid out, get your pills, your painkillers that you need, hydration stuff, all laid out. I like it nice and neat. I always hated when I was sat either side of players that were messy. There's loads of them, stuff everywhere. I'd always be like, look, keep your shit on your side. Because I like, you know.
Who's messy?
Who was messy next to me? Jack Noll was always quite neat. Anthony Watson's quite messy. He doesn't like order at all. He's just whatever. Joe Marchant as well. He's quite messy. No order. A lot of those young lads, they don't have order. I need order, plan, precise, need know where my stuff is. And then I'd go out and do the same sort of, at the same time, same warm-up routine. But then once I'm in a tunnel, once I step over the white line, then I kind of switch like that. Yeah.
It's just the event itself is enough for you just to switch.
Yeah.
It's funny you say about the order as well. Like, I couldn't agree more. I say that, like, I'm thinking now my house is a bit untidy, but the antidote to self-doubt or doubt in general is understanding. So when you've got clarity and understanding on either in life where you're going, but in that instance, like, you've got understanding of where your kit is, where your pills are, where everything's lined up. Like, it's just another weight or pressure that you don't need to be thinking about.
Yeah.
And then you can focus on the things you need to.
Yeah. But then on the flip side, if I look at those guys I kind of mentioned there, what happens if, for me, something's out of place or, you know, you get those stresses? Whereas there, sometimes you think, oh, I wish I could be more relaxed like them.
Well, there's always a swing, isn't there, of like passive and excessive. So you get excessively organized or too passively disorganized.
Yeah.
But if you're wherever you swing in the middle of the pendulum, usually.
And you probably become more excessive when there's more pressure on. So like for England, in the England situations, I'm probably more like that. Whereas if I was back at club, I'd be less...
Yeah,
worried about that. If something like that, I'd be fine.
Because what, it's you do it more often or it's lower stakes?
I think it's just probably the lower stakes, less pressure, probably more comfortable in a club environment as opposed to what comes with playing for England and, you know, those high stakes that come with that. There's high stakes with clubs, don't get me wrong, but, you know, you've been through it so many times, stuff like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, interesting, mate. Fascinated about the Marmite shout as well. Like, my own mum called me Marmite as well. So where did you call yourself that or someone called you that?
No, I've just heard people say that.
About you, yeah.
About me. But you kind of get that from reading stuff. You kind of get that.
Mm.
There's never any in-between state with me. It's like, I absolutely fucking hate him. Or,
I know. Weird though.
Oh, he's a legend or whatever.
There's
no in-between.
Do you listen to any of that?
I did definitely. I think I struggled with that, and then I ended up taking myself off social media probably towards the latter stages of the few years of playing for England. It was just things like, I remember once going in to Twickenham and we used to get dropped off the bus and then walk through the crowd a bit. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Yeah,
it's like through the the lion gates, they call it, get dropped off outside, and they kind of set up a tunnel for you and you walk through. And I remember this is a very low moment, actually. I was getting a lot of heat in the media about getting picked, and I shouldn't have been picked for whatever reason. I'm not sure why I was getting so much heat. Maybe I wasn't playing well enough, I don't know. And we'd just come off the back of a loss, I think. But we were coming into Twickenham, and I was walking down that tunnel, and I hear someone shout, "Oh, Mike Brown, you're fucking shit, or you shouldn't be picked," or some of that. And I'm just thinking, wow, I'm about to represent my country. And I think it was from an England fan, from their accent, I'm guessing it was an England fan. And it was against Wales as well. I was already, you know, nervous and stuff. Been struggling in the week, dealing with all the noise a bit. And then to hear that at your home ground, you know, when you love playing for England so much, you put so much into it, it's tough, you know. But off the back of that, I got man of match. So, really? You know, it's a good way of giving two fingers up to someone like that. But it's just disappointing because you just want back into that moment. But, you know, it's sport. People are entitled to their opinions. I think sometimes it goes over that, especially on social media. But, yeah, that was a tough moment. Yeah.
Strange, isn't it? I think the quote of the man in the arena comes to mind.
Yeah.
Because so often, you know, the people who are observing and who aren't actually doing the thing are the ones who are happy to pass opinion, and it's usually coming from insecurity or jealousy or something similar.
Yeah.
Whereas, like you said, all you need is some support.
Yeah.
And I think people, because they literally just can't grasp or understand what you go through.
Yeah.
What you're going through and what you're having to do in order to reach that level.
Yeah.
So their opinion is actually completely null and void. It's redundant, right? But it doesn't stop it affecting you and hurting you.
Yeah, I just wish I'd reached out to people to deal with it, or having someone like Craig White, who we've both seen, I'm sure we'll talk about later, but will give you certain coping mechanisms or ways of dealing with that sort of thing. Mm. Instead, I shied away from, you know, taking myself off social media. But you can't hide away from it, you can't run away from it, because even if you don't read anything and you don't go on your social media, someone will message you and go, "Oh, have you seen what someone said about you in the press?" No, but now I've heard about it. Thanks a lot. It's on my mind. I'm not going to go read it, but it's on my mind, thinking, what have they said? Why are they saying that? Especially someone like me, who's an overthinker, an over-worrier. You spend a lot of time my own thoughts, not in a weird way, but, you know, being introvert and, you know, spend more time on my own. That's where you feel comfortable. I should have taking ownership, responsibility of that, realizing that, and meet it head on by having coping mechanisms to deal with that.
Mm. What were they then? These, you know, you're saying like overthinking or overwhelming, or what was like? Because what's coming to my mind again there is I spoke with James Haskell on the podcast. Yeah. This is probably a year and a bit ago, who speaks quite openly about that as well. And he had a therapist and he had sports psychology and stuff, and speaks very highly of it, but got a lot of stick for it when he did. His was all about self-belief and, you know.
Which you think was weird, right? Because he comes across as great self-belief and deals with it so well. Like when he speaks about that social media stuff, it's like, you know, water for a duck's back. And if there was someone I wish I could have been more in those situations, would be someone like him.
Yeah.
But then to hear that he's actually dealt with it is good.
Well, sometimes the, you know, again, passive or excessive, the excessive bravado is a cover-up of the deeper insecurity anyway. So not saying that that's the case for Husky. He's obviously got a big personality anyway, but this was, it was especially in the early part of his career when he was first at, I think it was Wasps, wasn't it?
When he
was
first. Yeah.
And then when he went traveling or like went and played in France, etc. Like, so yeah, I think if you asked everybody, it would be a very high percentage of people who did suffer from that. You know, the doubts and the internal dialogue, unless you're firing every week, which no one does. So what was it like, if you could put words to what was going on internally, like what was it that you were thinking?
Oh, wow. Like, you should be overthinking about, am I playing well? Have I trained well? You know, the teams are coming up, the teams you just played against, you know, the feedback you're getting, because as a sportsman, you're getting feedback constantly, right, from all angles, from people you should be listening to, coaches, teammates, to who you shouldn't be listening to, press and social media, you know, people in your family giving you feedback. You're constantly getting it all the time. It's probably like not many other jobs are like that, I can imagine. So you're getting all that in and it's just sat there, and if you can't deal with it and being able to filter it. And when you're in environments like I was in with someone like Eddie Jones, for example, you're constantly worried about someone like that. What's he thinking about you? He'll message you at like during games for your club about certain situations you've done badly in a game. And you know what it's like, right? After a game, you first thing you do, look at your phone. Eddie Jones, you're like, oh no.
So a club game, something that happened and then he'd message you about
that. Yeah, I remember playing Sarries, which is already a big game for Harlequins. Someone's grown up a Harlequins. That's the team you want to beat, Saracens. At Wembley, I made a line break and then tried to take someone on, placed the ball back for a ruck and knocked it on or something, which isn't good enough. I know that, obviously. And I'd be an overthinker. I'm thinking about how I messed up that moment. We end up losing it anyway. So you're already annoyed about that, especially being a Quinn through and through. You want to beat Sarries. You're already pretty pissed off about losing to them. There was a rival with me and Alex Goode as well, both trying course, to get in the England team. And he, like he always does, played pretty well. And you think about those moments you messed up. And then first thing I do, look at my phone, Eddie Jones, minute, I don't know, it's like 54 or something. Line break, blew it. And I'm thinking, that's what he said. I'm thinking, I've messed up here.
What does that do though for your confidence, like, to have you?
Well, exactly, right? Yeah, exactly. So yeah,
line break, blew it.
Yeah,
jeez.
And then you're thinking about that for the rest of the week.
Yeah.
And are you going to get picked for England? You know, how, where does that leave you standing there? And if it comes too much, if you're thinking about all those things all the time, so that's where you need those things to filter that. And
yeah it's hard because being someone who does a job like you do, like you're in the public eye, and it's almost, it's not, but it almost is the right of the public to have those opinions, because you're in the public eye, you're doing a job you love and all those things. But at the same time, and maybe a lot of people can relate to this with the modern day of social media and the amount of stimulus that we all have day to day anyway, won't be comparable, but generally we've got too much going in our minds, haven't we? To be able to sift through and, like, you know, focus on the right thoughts. But how did you, how do you ultimately cope with it then? You said you came off socials. What else?
You try and speak to people, I think. Ultimately, I end up losing my place in the England team. I think a lot of that was probably not being able to deal with that sort of thing. So, like I said, with Eddie Jones, you're already in that environment, which is tough, ruthless, you know, sometimes too much on the fear side for players, especially if you're not in that main group of players that he had. And I ultimately lost my place, so I didn't deal with it, did I? Otherwise, I would have gone to that World Cup.
What do you think then, that the it was the overthinking ultimately?
I think so. I think I ended up playing with fear. So it wasn't like I was having really bad games, but I don't think, I was probably going into games thinking, don't make any errors, just do your job, rather than I'm going to go and enjoy this by doing this and doing that, what I do well. And then if you go in with a certain mindset, you probably make more errors, as if you're just going out and expressing yourself, being decisive, not overthinking stuff, then you can probably go out and have a good game. So
that's interesting though, and for context, like, I'm sure everyone who listens to this knows exactly who you are, but like a Harlequins legend, you there for, what was it in total, like
19 years?
19 years, yeah, so, is that including the academy?
Yeah
19 years.
Yeah
Wow. So Harlequins legend and then England legend as well. 72 England
caps? 72, yeah.
And quite frankly, like, one of the most exciting fullbacks England's ever had.
Like, I'm glad you said that. I don't get that feedback much.
Really?
Or didn't feel like I get... No, I felt like I took massive value in the basics of a fullback and getting those spot on. And so one of my two strengths, high ball. Another one was making sure I was good last line defence. And then I think my counter-attack was good as well. But I feel like the counter-attack didn't really get looked upon too much. And I was just seen as a boring fullback because I was good at high ball and good at tackling, just seen as a defensive fullback.
Right.
Especially for 6 of my 8 years with England, I was top of meters made at the end of campaigns. I was top of defenders beating for campaigns, carries. And then this whole bandwagon started, I never passed the ball. So then that was playing on my mind, going back to that. Then I try and force stuff too much and take away from my decisiveness. Yeah, so I think sometimes I feel like people didn't really take in the good stuff and just saw me as a boring fullback because I had so much value on the high ball and made sure I was good at that first and foremost, and then everything built off that for me. I felt like people forgot about the good stuff I did.
Firstly, it's great to hear you talk about the high ball and talk about the fundamentals and the simple things, right? Because as a professional, that's where it all begins.
Yeah, and that's what I say to every single young player. I say, best at basics. This is actually an Eddie term, best at basics, he always used to say to us. And that for me, I started early on in terms of fullback stuff, high ball, one-on-one tackling, decision-making from the back. One of the best bits of feedback I got from a player was Jamie Roberts, Wales legend who joined Quinns. He said to me, I never realised this until I've played with you, but you never seem to make an error at the back in terms of your decision-making, which for us in the front line is amazing because we know if the ball's kicked over our heads after we've, you know, been pounding in terms of our defence, we know we've got a safe pair of hands who will put us back on the front foot or look after us so then we can get back into our shape and stuff. So that for me was great feedback because that's something I always wanted to make sure I did. People I played with, I wanted them to have huge trust in me to be able to do my job and not put them under pressure. That's what I wanted. So, you know, I worked so hard on those fundamentals, and I say that to every single young player. Best at basics first, fundamentals of your position, whatever they are, and then everything else will build on that. The confidence will come off that. The highlight reel will come off that. Whereas I think with social media and young players seeing that, they look at the highlight reel first. Did I make a line break? Oh yeah, brilliant. But then you dropped your high ball, you missed touch on a kick, you sliced one and you missed your tackle and they scored. So, you know, that's what I think. We're too focused on the highlight reels sometimes.
Yeah, it's really interesting, mate. But like, even saying that though, like to offer the other perspective, saying people forget about it. Like what all the things that come to mind, and maybe this is bad and it's media enhanced, but like it's all the highlights. It's the highlights. It's the ball going out against Australia and you keeping it in and, you know, breaking like 3-4 tackles. Like it's all those moments when, frankly, it's like, you know, a joy to watch, like poetry, taking on players, like the sidesteps. And that's what I remember of you, especially early England career. So I don't think that people would have forgotten that. I don't think people would have forgotten that.
Yeah, I hope not. I hope not. Because, yeah, I the main thing for me is whatever shirt I was in, whether it be Quinns, England, or even Newcastle, only being there a year, I wanted people that were watching the game to think, oh, he's putting in the effort and cares as much as if we were in that position to be lucky enough to put on that shirt. That's all I wanted, that's all I wanted people to see.
So the main thing you wanted was what? So that you represented the shirt as if somebody
So if I was sat watching a player desperate to be in their position and lucky enough to be in their position, if I had that one opportunity, put as much work ethic and effort into every action that I did.
Touching on that again, like, you know, ultimately saying that the overthinking and all that external pressures and opinions and judgments and criticisms led to you perhaps losing the starting position at fullback for England. How would you have wanted to be coached? You know, Harlequins drop a ball or whatever the example was, getting that text from Eddie, like, you know, how would you have benefited from being coached rather than the way that you were?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say because I think it goes back to I should have taken ownership responsibility of what I was dealing with at the time to be able to deal with that for me as an individual player. So then I came through it. I just think in the environment, probably less based on fear, I think.
So just it's your own, or the environment was like that as well?
I think the environment was sometimes based too much on fear because Eddie is very demanding, which isn't always a bad thing if it's done the right way. He's very ruthless, very direct at points. It's a very intense environment and he's an intense guy. There just needs to be more of a balance for me. And I think probably England lost that. I think when he came in, there was a decent enough balance. But then the latter stages of my time with England probably wasn't, I don't think. And I think that shows in the turn, and the staff got it worse than the players. Look, I was in those meetings. So, but you could just see when some of the staff came out of those meetings. So you've played football, right? Yeah. So you've sat in the physio room. That's the hub of the energy, you know, the enjoyment of the environment. Everyone goes in there to chat and piss about, get some treatment, but converse and socialise. You'd be sat in there in those moments, the good moments in the physio room, and you'd see like the head of medical or head physio walking after one of the meetings just like this, just like, you know, blank face, dead behind the eyes, just stressed.
Traumatised.
And you'd be like, yeah, he's just had the meeting with Eddie, hasn't he? The daily department meeting. And he'd just walk in, just usually they'd go quietly behind their desk, just sit down and be like, do nothing for a few minutes. And then they'd be back in the game. But you can see in the turnover of staff that he has, it's I don't know.
I think that was a pressure from him though. Like, you know, we talked about the pressure that you had, like he had his way, his leadership style, his culture you're trying to create. Mm. It wasn't necessarily working. So he feels, well, that's open to debate.
Yeah, open to debate. They got to the World Cup final, exactly. Right? So who am I to say either way?
But the more it wasn't working, but say pre-World Cup, the more pressure he feels to enforce his style and make it work.
Yeah, potentially. It's hard, isn't it? Because, you know, like you said, it's your perception of what works and what doesn't. Then he got to World Cup final. But there was, you know, the first 2 years when we were unbelievably successful, and then a couple of years where we really weren't. And then that's when I dropped out. But then they did then go to the World Cup final. But maybe they could have won the World Cup final if things were a tiny bit different. I'm just talking about my own experiences and my perspective, I guess. And then in reflection, how would I want to lead that sort of environment? I just think there's got to be a balance if you are in that environment between the high performance, which was Eddie was brilliant at, and he was a real eye-opener into a high performance environment and what it takes to prepare to win and doing all the little things in the week, stretches, recovery, the intensity we had to train on the field. Like his sessions, I loved because the intensity and the tempo and the physicality of those sessions, I loved it. But then there's got to be more of a healthy balance. You know, I don't think it's healthy having that amount of turnover of staff. There's got to be something going on there, and how players are leaving the environment and not speaking that highly of it. There's got to be something there. So there's got to be a balance between high performance and a healthy environment, in my opinion. Especially nowadays with the generation coming through, they need that balance, I think. They need the balance of, you know, the enjoyment and having more involvement in and responsibility of taking ownership on decisions made and allowing them to do that, and more guidance and support as opposed to being direct and ruthless and intense, I think. So, yeah, just that balance, I think.
Yeah, mate, really fascinating and great insight. And this goes for sport and business, but, you know, they say don't coach the player, coach the person. Like if you're not personable with the player, don't understand them and who they are, how can you understand their communication style? How can you understand what motivates them?
It's hugely important now, isn't it? Massive.
Yeah. And I think that's probably more like softer skills, isn't it? Or what was probably considered softer skills before.
Yeah. And how do you measure the soft skills? It's hard, isn't it? But what I would say about Eddie though, like I was saying there, like in terms of his rugby experience, knowledge, his session planning, the sessions that he put on, him being able to make us understand what it takes to be a high performance athlete and the preparation needed and everything that goes into that, like second to none for my career. That was a real eye-opener. He was excellent. So yeah, do have massive respect for him in terms of that.
What was the biggest thing that he offered as far as the high performance side of things?
Oh, everything. Like everything I've just listed, the preparation you need. So preparation in terms of your recovery and how we did that every day, not just ticking a box, but actually doing it properly and finding the best one that works for you and doing it to a high standard. The meetings that he put on, the style of meetings and the information and knowledge that he put in, but also that we would get. The sessions, how intense they were, you know, from the minute you were on that field till you walked off, you did not stop. you'd have like 30 seconds for a water break. Like it was like boom, boom, boom. 12v12, go to that drill, come back, 12v12, this game, that game. You know, look at the board, get your bib on, right, go, we're off. I loved it because it was like game related. It was like intense. It was, you know, the fittest I would have ever been. Loved that intensity in terms of the training, and the tempo and the physicality, the best players on the field, you know, training as if they were playing in moments. Like it was, I love that sort of stuff. So that was great. Just the detail in everything.
Because you like loved it so much. Where was the downfall between yours and his relationship?
It was when he didn't see you as that starter anymore. He kind of would switch a bit confirmation bias, the way he talked to you, the way I'd have moments in training where he'd just suddenly shout at me for no reason, or a reason that he thought was the reason. But yeah, I didn't really, I think for me, he knew how much I cared for playing for England, how much effort I put in, extra effort, which I'm sure a lot of the lads do, but he knew that. You know, there was one moment where I had a key for Pennyhill Park to go and do my extra sessions with the head of SNC, Dean Benton. They got me an extra key. So he knew I was doing all the extra stuff in terms of that, which he wanted, but also I wanted to keep getting better and going down there and doing kicking sessions with Johnny Wilkinson and all those little ex-Brits. He knew how much I cared because he told people he knew how much I cared and they said that to me. So I think when someone loves it and cares for playing that much and is doing all these extra things, which I'm sure a lot of players were, I think you can just do it in a bit better way, I think. And then at the end with the Bentio thing, which I'm sure you've read about.
I'm familiar with the story. But yeah. If you want to add context.
Then. Yeah, so anyone knows rugby. So we were in a World Cup camp. And it was away in Treviso. And at the end of the World Cup camp, we had like a team social, which, you know, they were very insistent and encouraging that everyone got involved in, which is fine. I'm not a big drinker, but some lads are more drinkers than me. So they did their thing and I had a couple. And I actually was enjoying it, you know, sat with players that I got on really well, Slady, Mark Wilson, Don Brandt, Joe Marchant, people like that. Just having a nice relaxing afternoon on a beachfront bar. After an incredibly intense 2 weeks, like it was the hardest 2 weeks training I've probably ever been involved in, with the humidity, the intensity of training, the heat. So we were going to very much relax and get on with it. Some of the guys who drank too much did some things, and anyone listening can go and read about it. And then Tio was one of those ones who I think was drinking too much, got a bit rowdy and decided his focus of wind up and things like that was going to be on me. So that ended up with us two kind of coming to head. He swung for me, clipped me on the eye, and on the walk, that was walking back to the coach at the end of the sort of late afternoon. And then off the back of that, it was the way that kind of got dealt with. So Eddie, I felt, kind of used that as a reason to say I wasn't getting picked for the World Cup. Obviously already incredibly disappointed, but that wasn't the reason I wasn't getting picked. For World Cup. I kind of felt it for the 2 weeks I was there, to be honest. He makes it quite obvious, in my opinion, probably going back to what we're talking about there, doing things a certain way, he makes it very obvious. So when I went back at him on the phone about this and him trying to use it as an excuse, he didn't like it, because if you go back at Eddie, as players have found out, even though it was a very respectful way, my wife was listening to the conversation, I had it on loudspeaker, so she heard it all. He just flew off the handle and went crazy.
What did you say to him on the phone?
So he basically said, I can't have that in my squad. I've had reports from, I don't know, the security over there or whoever that he's talking about what happened. So I said, can I see these reports? You know, with all due respect, I didn't really do anything wrong and, you know, handled myself the best way I could in that situation. For the afternoon, you can ask players if you want. So, I don't agree with that reason for dropping me. Yeah, it went from there, just went off and won. But then he switches back at the end going, but stay ready in case there's injury. And I'm like, I had my ears blown off about, you know, coming back at you. And then you switch again. Honestly, sometimes you didn't really know where you stood with him. So it was a weird one, because you're already disappointed. You're not, obviously hugely disappointed you're not going to the World Cup, and hugely disappointed you know, we're putting all that in for 4 year cycle. So just give me the real reason. If you don't have one, tell me to have one, but don't make up an excuse and use that one, which was an upsetting situation for me as it was. And then it just got swept under the carpet and that was it. And you just left to deal with that sort of thing. And then it comes out in the press, you're having to deal with that. You can't really say anything because you're worried if someone gets injured for England, will you be the next one in? But if I say anything about the TO situation and how that's dealt with, I'm not going to be the next one in, knowing how Eddie is and things like that. So, you know, it's a hard situation to be in. You can't say your bit. So everyone's, you know, just assuming that you had a fight and it was your fault or both your faults. So it's a hard situation to be in, and it's disappointing to end like that, really.
Yeah, it's really tough, mate. What do you think the real reason was, if you thought about it, just for you, like, how do you feel it panned out?
What was the real... No, I think the real reason was he just wanted something different, maybe, that he saw in Elliot Daly as a fullback compared to me.
Like, that's okay if he told you that, right?
Well, it's not as an individual, is it? You won't take it well, but what can you say to that?
Yeah.
Just be like, well, it's his opinion, isn't it?
Well, you can still disagree.
But I'd rather that than some BS reason of a fight that you were trying your best to get out of for the whole afternoon, and people will back you and say that. I'd rather that, because that's not the way I want to go out. That's not the reason I'm not getting picked for World Cup. I was desperate to be in.
Yeah.
I'd rather just him say that. And, you know, if he can do that stuff different to me, then fine.
Yeah. Mate, I draw so many similarities, like from a personality perspective from you, like a lot. Like I said before, like my mum called me Marmite. Like, I don't know if I'm still as much. I don't know if you would see yourself still as much like that, but I think really what that means for both of us is that we're just comfortable being ourselves. Like, we're happy to be ourselves, and we're not happy to roll over on someone else's opinion or from someone else's perspective, which means pushing back sometimes. What's difficult, especially in the sporting environment, because it's such a strange world, is like there are personalities that do things that would never be forgiven in, like, business, for example. When I played football in America, I think I still dislike my manager that I had now. I haven't fully got over it. We just didn't get on, didn't see eye to eye. He didn't like, at the time I don't know if I want to say worse version of myself, but I was very alpha, very aggressive, very assertive. And I felt like I probably had that team more than him, maybe.
Yeah.
He did things like, if I scored two goals, he'd take me off, or things like that, or he'd drop me on a big game, or things that were just to wind me up. Or when I got injured, the first thing he said in the changing room for the next game was, we've got the strongest team out that we could have as a team is out now. And he didn't mean because I was injured, he meant because I'm not playing. Things like that. So I still dislike him now. So I don't know, do you still hold on to anything from that experience of Eddie?
Not dislike. Like, I've seen him since, and he's very good at anything that's happened, just shrugging it off. And I don't know if he forgets about it, but it's like he's forgotten about it, which is kind of admirable, because, you know, you have to, I guess in that sort of job, you have to shrug things off and move on very quickly. Or, I don't know, it's just soulless, he doesn't care, I don't know. So I've seen he visited Newcastle, see some of the players, and his conversation is like, it's fine. But it's interesting you say feeling comfortable with how you are. I don't think at times I was, and then you try and maybe be a different way or hide from that. So there's times of being that quiet introvert, I'm not comfortable in, and you think you should be another way. Or there's times where I'd be getting hammered for being a certain way in the field, you know, too aggressive and too confrontational, and then people would spin it on, oh, he's ill-disciplined, when I never was, really. And then you kind of pull back from being that person, and then you're not getting the best of yourself out of yourself on the field. I think I did that occasions in the England environment. I think out of fear of my place and stuff, I'd pull back from being that person that could give opinion or would want to. I'd just be like, oh no, I'm just going to sit at the back and let other people give their opinions, because, you know, they've got bigger standing in the team now, and I'm just going to worry about looking after myself and hanging on to playing. And then ultimately that doesn't help you, because I end up getting dropped. So yeah, I think it goes up and down. Whereas now I've learned, I will never want to be how I was the last one, maybe 2 years, I was being, I was like a shadow of myself. Like I wouldn't want to be like that.
What, like when you were at Newcastle, do you mean?
Yeah, so like at Newcastle, I made sure I give my opinion, not in a bad way, I don't think. And I'm sure the players would have told me if I was, because you're going into a new environment. Yeah, they know that you've done a bit in your career, and I could very much come in and be like, I know it all, we're going to do this, and be a bit of a dick. But hopefully I wasn't. Yeah, they didn't tell me I was. So, and the Geordie lads would usually tell you if you were. But offering my opinion challenged my teammates, but also the coaches, which I don't think they liked, because they weren't used to that. And then, but then players, my teammates saw that, then that, you know, then I think gave them a little thing where, oh yeah, we could do that. We're going to challenge a bit and we're going to say what we think and offer our opinion. And again, not in a bad way. So it started to kind of feed into the other players around me, which at Newcastle, which I felt was quite good. So I think the long story short is I'm now going to be myself, obviously keep learning, developing. If I want to be a leader in elite sport with my transition, being able to adapt and be a good leader and constantly reflecting and check and challenge myself on that. But I'm never going to be like I was in those last 2 years and shadow myself and not be what people like to say, true to yourself. Mm. Probably the best way to put it is I'm going to try and be true to myself and not be like that.
Amazing. Well, that's all we can do, isn't it? But like, do you know what interests me about that, mate? Is that I'm interested to know who, because it sounds, you're basically saying that you put too much emphasis on external opinion and that altered 100%. The way that you behaved. But you say you didn't drink much and rugby's a heavy drinking culture. You know, I spoke to Hask, I've read his book, you know, those sorts of people, same with Hartley,
yeah.
Jack Knoll, I've had on the podcast as well, Jinxie, Jamie George, you know, same, all these lads, like, it's a very heavy drinking culture. Similar to yourself, although when I played football, I did drink a lot, but I've not drank for 2 years. I haven't, other than my brother's wedding and stag do, I haven't drank for 2 years. You stay true to yourself in those environments. You got the key to Penny Hill Park. Like, you might have had players being, oh, fucking Mikey, you know.
It was like being a non-drinker in the rugby fight. It's not like I'm not a drinker. I would drink in certain situations, but I choose not to because it doesn't hold any value to me in any part of my life. Like, I don't see any value to it. Even team socials during the season, I don't really drink, which frustrates some players, some teammates. But like at the end of campaigns with England, I would, because it'd been so intense, you'd have a good drink. Or end of season social, the ones I turned up for. Again, I got a lot of stick for not sometimes not turning up. Because it just was not really my thing. And yeah, just didn't see value in it with performance wise. So.
But I don't think that's a bad thing, mate. Like, You called yourself introverted. Would you say you're introverted?
Yeah, definitely.
So is that okay to not want to go to the social?
No, not for the team.
Not for the team.
Well, I think the team view would be no.
Mm.
But sometimes, as an individual, I needed to do certain things to not. I just didn't feel comfortable in those situations, or didn't want to be part of those situations. Which wouldn't sit right with some other people because they think team all the time.
Mm.
Or I would go to socials and duck out when it starts getting too much because it's just not, wasn't what I was about anymore. And it wasn't, didn't see any value in it. So
I can certainly say, like I say, I've had about 2 years without a drink and I feel a million times better. And it was, the trigger for me was having my daughter and I couldn't cope with the sleepless nights.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, building my own company and drinking at the weekend and or whenever. So I'm very similar, although I do value it at certain times.
Yeah.
It's still good, but.
Yeah, I think, like I said, there is times. There has to be a really good reason for me wanting to drink. I'm not that person who's sitting and have a glass of wine or something. It's just, like, I just don't see where in my life, even now, not playing, I don't see where it fits in, you know, with your family. Mm-hmm. Again, sleepless nights.
Yeah.
If I want to be best I can be for my son and my wife and be present and enjoy the weekend or small amount of time we have, then drink's not going to help me do that. In terms of my transition stuff, it's not going to help me really with that. And staying fit and healthy is not going to help me with that. So I don't know.
It's so interesting that you're saying that because I've thought about this so many times where, like, you know, your best mate at school, who you got on with really well, don't see each other for years, and then you see each other again and you're just completely different.
Yeah.
Because in that space of time, your values have changed or your priorities have changed. And that's okay. But a lot of the time, like if your values are different to the collective, for example, you're not going to connect with them in the same way.
Mm.
And that can be really challenging. And that even might be, a, you know, something that we can point out for the England thing. That, you know, you just were different to the group, or I don't know, I'm making this up. I'm just sort of speaking my thoughts. But it's difficult for people who want to go on a different journey or grow or be better or develop. And that sometimes means that those who don't mirror your values aren't going to be able to see eye to eye, and vice versa. You know, people who have the higher standards aren't going to be able to see the eye to eye with others as well.
Yeah, there's certain things that I do in terms of my personality or values, and I look at other people sometimes and you think, oh, why are they doing that?
Mm.
But that's because that's what they want to do. And sometimes you have to remember, oh yeah, that's your own bias. Like, you know, what's their perspective? Why are they doing that? What value do they have? It's interesting to say about feeling comfortable. I do feel like a lot of my career, I did feel uncomfortable in certain situations, probably from being an introvert and stuff like that. So, and I learned this with my uni, introverts, they can be in big group environments and things like that, but it takes a lot of energy away from them. Whereas extroverts, they like being in those big groups and social situations because they get energy from it. And when you put it like that, I can reflect on my career and see why sometimes I'd have to take myself away, sit in my room a lot, especially with England. When you're there all day, every day, it would be incredibly exhausting for me being in a team sport as an introvert. Thinking about it now, no wonder I was exhausted during England camp at the end of the day. And probably some people would look at me and go, why is he sat in his room for so long? But that was where I'd go and get my energy back, sit and have a quiet moment to myself, you know, a bit of time on my own. Yeah, so it's interesting when you take all these different perspectives and personalities into account.
Oh, definitely. Like, so a lot of the owners of the biggest companies are introverted. There's so many good things about introverts, like the ability to listen more, the ability to understand others more, like all these things. Mm. But the emphasis is on us to understand ourselves, but it's also on the leader of that, if it's a team or whatever, you know, the person who's leading that, or doesn't have to be necessarily the business, but leading that person, there's an emphasis on them as well to understand that person as well, which isn't always done.
Yeah. I very much had to learn that later on in my career, learning about other people, because I think would just expect, I'd be always like, why can't they just be like me? And especially in the club situation, why aren't they so driven? Why are they just happy to be squad players? Why aren't they as diligent with their, I don't know, recovery and stuff? Why aren't they as aggressive when they're on the field, or loud, or focused, or intense as I am on the field? And why don't they like feedback a certain way? You know, very, and I would give it very direct, where they need different things. I had to learn that very much later on in my career. So that was interesting to learn. So someone like Joe Marchant, for example, he's very, very laid back. You have to be very softly with him. And there was times where he would clash, especially during games, because I'd be like, right, I need you to fucking do this now, get it done, in that sort of way. And he wouldn't like that. I'd have to kind of, especially in training, use different ways of trying to get through to him.
Arm around the shoulder.
He was so frustrating, I could tell you. He was one of the most frustrated people because he's so different to me in a rugby context. So yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I've had to learn that a lot.
Yeah, I was an arm around the shoulder player. I needed to be told I was great to get my confidence.
I think everyone does though, right? I think everyone does.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
But I think people could be a bit more direct with me. Well, I just want feedback. Tell me direct, to the point, so I can go and do it. That's all I want. Honest feedback, boom, go.
Yeah.
Where some people are like, oh, you've got to try this.
Yeah,
how about this? Or what do you think of that? No, just tell me, boom, I'm onto it.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
This episode is brought to you by Hux. Hux is a health company created to inspire you to find your daily edge. I've been trying Hux for the last few months, and it's become my trusted health supplement of choice. And I love that its range of products can, and for me, should be used every day from wake until sleep. Hux consists of high-quality, potent supplements across four categories. Their superfood blend provides you with 17 superfoods, including vitamin A, B, C, and D, and a hit of plant protein. The hydration tablets hydrate you quickly in unbelievably good flavors. Nootropics support those focus periods and long-term brain health. And finally, Hux's sleep products with award-winning ingredients like Levigin to support your recovery through deeper, more restorative sleep. I've been using superfood and hydration for the last few months and have noticed a drastic improvement in sustained energy and my sleep. In fact, having met the team, tried the products, and seen the vision, I decided to become an early stage investor myself, and I'm so excited to be a part of this journey. You'll be seeing loads more from Hux, and I can't wait to see and hear from people being supported by the products. To get involved, visit huxhealth.com or at Hux Health on all socials and use the code TF20 for 20% off all products, including their subscription. Thanks, guys. I hope you enjoy.
Mate, what was the driver, right? And the thought behind this question is people like Danny Cipriani, for example.
Yeah.
His own man.
Yeah.
Had his own demons.
Yeah.
They drove him to be an incredible, he was incredible talent anyway, but drove him to be an incredible player, but arguably was his downfall as well. Right? I've got my own demons, which have driven me in areas, and probably my downfall was like, I just couldn't cope with authority or people telling me what to do. Like, that's what stopped me really progressing any further until I started to realize that about myself. And now I work for myself and no one around. So maybe I'm still not over it. But do you draw anything from Danny's situation with England or anything else? And do you know what your thing was or your void or whatever it was that like drove you and motivated you to become the great player that you were?
Danny's situation. Danny was one of those guys that I've just talked about that would be incredibly frustrating to someone like me because we're so different, but I have huge respect for him and love him as a bloke because he's always so kind. Well, to me anyway, like whenever there's been bad moments in the career, he'd be someone that would message me, or when I speak to him, be so kind. So I have huge respect for him and appreciate him for that. But on the other side, incredibly frustrating because he's so different from me, you know, lives in chaos in terms of, you know, no structure and very relaxed with certain things like timekeeping and stuff. So he was in the England camp with me under Stuart Lancaster for 2015 World Cup. And both of us were training with Margot Wells, who's a speed and power coach, off-site, as well as our training on camp at Pennyhill Park. So what we would do, and Stuart was great at letting us do this, was certain days and certain parts of the day, we were allowed to drive to Guildford, which was like half an hour away. He didn't have a car at the time, and we'd go and train with her and then come back and do the session. He didn't have a car at the time, so I had to give him a lift. And I would be strict, right, we need even at this time, so because I know it takes half an hour to get there, the session will take an hour, half an hour to get back. I know exactly, it's all scheduled, it basically, in my head, this is the schedule, stick to it. I get very nervous if we're not leaving 5 minutes before I said we should leave. You know, I like to be punctual on time and have a schedule. I'm sat in the car park waiting for him. I say we were leaving at like, I don't know, 12. It's getting 5:02. I'm like, where is he? I'm ringing him. No answer. 12 o'clock, still no answer. And then he rings me. Oh yeah, I'm coming. I'm like, mate, I'm leaving. I'm about to drive out and leave you here now. Literally, I'm coming. 15 minutes later, I'm about to pull out of the car park and join in the long drive to the main road. I see him walking out the hotel, literally wombling down the road, not a care in the world, looking around. I'm like, Sips, hurry the fuck up. Back, beeping the horn, would you hurry up? He's like, what are you on about? We got loads of time. And I'm just like, oh my God, stressed, driving all the way there, trying to make up time. And he just doesn't care, putting his music on. So that side of him would stress me out. But yeah, what a great player when he was on form. It's just a shame we didn't see more of it, I guess. And I can't remember the other question because I was waffling on about Sips so much.
Amazing, I love that. Just, you know, any similarities or, that sounds like not, but... but
oh, the driver.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people talk about trauma as a big driver for successful people. And I think that was very much me a case for me in what I've managed to achieve in my sporting career. And I think it comes from probably parents divorcing when I was around 10, 11, I think. After that, not seeing my mum since. Yeah, and the trauma that that comes with. I say to my wife all the time, my son's got it too easy. He needs a bit of trauma. She's like, trauma, how can you say that? And I'm like, not in the really extreme trauma I'm talking about, but, you know, he needs a bit of struggle in his life. And I think everyone needs a little bit of struggle in life to learn how to be resilient, deal with it, bounce back, you know, find a way. I think young athletes can't deal with that sort of thing anymore, mm-hmm. and be resilient and be able to bounce back or just get up in the morning and find a way. Sometimes people want it too easy, I think. Yeah. But you read a lot about trauma being sort of a catapult to success, yeah. I think. So that was probably mine.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, mate. So you never saw your mum after the divorce?
No, I haven't seen her since. Only, I think, once. She turned up at a Quinns game, and after the game, we always do the lap of talking to supporters or your family members in the crowd, come up to the side of the pitch. And I did that once, and I think I was talking to my wife, maybe, or friends, and she kind of tapped me on the shoulder and went hello and walked off. So it was, yeah, weird exchange. But yeah, I don't know why, really. I think maybe she was dealing with the trauma of what happened with my mum and dad splitting up and stuff. And yeah, I don't know. Maybe she thought it was on us to get in touch with her, and the fact we stayed with my dad when she left and weren't kind of begging her or asking her to go back and live with her. Maybe she, trying to see it from her perspective, was upset with that. But I don't think a child of that age should have the responsibility to go and do that. And she could have easily come to our schools or later on in my college, which actually was, I was going to college where she lived, because I know she was from Winchester, and that's where my college was, where we lived in Salisbury originally. So she could have easily come, but she didn't start coming until I started playing for Quinns, that I know of. So then you're thinking a bit like, how does that work then? And I don't think she tried to reach out to my sister at all as well until later on. And then my sister was a bit like, well, you were going to Mike's rugby matches, we didn't come try and reach out to me, which you could have easily done. So then, you know, my sister's straight away thinking, why is she doing that? She wasn't bothered before, whether she was or not, you know, don't know her perspective fully. But, and then once time goes on, you kind of like, I guess you kind of lose that bond with your mum after that long. So there's no feeling there anymore. I guess that sounds like quite heartless and soulless, but after so long not seeing someone, it's a bit like, well, I've managed without you, I've been doing my life without you, I've got through everything without you. So then you lose that urge to speak to them anymore. So then that's why I haven't got in contact since. So yeah, that's
it was a funny one though, mate, because like, as much as this podcast is about performance and all these other things, like what we sometimes get confused with, this is only something I've realized recently, is that we're not success creatures, we're survival creatures. And that goes for when you're playing in the team or whatever. So like, how do you translate survival in the team? It's getting picked, because if I get picked, then I can play. If I play well, get good feedback, then I'll keep playing, I'll get another contract and all those other things. Like, we're not success creatures, we're survival creatures. And in your personal life, you translated that as, well, your mum's not helping you survive anymore.
Yeah.
I think you switch it off at some stage as well.
Yeah, I think that's probably what I've done, yeah. I think, like, I don't even really get upset about it anymore. I would have before. It's tough. It's tough. But then you just make sure that as a parent, which I am now, you don't allow that to happen to your children, I guess. So, but again, I don't know her perspective. As time's gone on, I haven't even thought about her perspective. So, yes, it's Yes, weird. I don't really know. Yeah, you don't know what to say, do you?
Yeah, and it's hard. But you know, you might not have been on the Queen's pitch or in Twickenham without it.
Yeah, exactly.
You never know.
Exactly. But I wouldn't want anyone else to go through it because it was early on. It's hard, isn't it? It's hard.
Imagine.
Yeah.
I want to talk about some of those kind of intuitive moments where, like, peak Mike Brown was just like taking players on, sidestepping players. Like, are they moments? Does it slow down for you? Like, do you remember it? Like, what's going on for you that allows you to access that? Because it is peak you. You know, no one could touch you. I don't know if there's any. Did you have any nicknames as a player?
Well, only from outside people, like Angry Man.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the lads like to call me Gollum sometimes because Nick Easter, my Quins and England teammate for a bit, he used to do this sketch at the end of seasons of like someone would film him doing impressions and dressing up as people. And he did one of me one year where he pretended to be Gollum because I liked to run with the ball and never passed. And, you know, like my precious doing that. Because I had a shaved head as well, like it fit. So he did one of that and then it stuck. So, yeah, unfortunately, I had that for a little bit. But only a few of the old school players would call me that.
Yeah, yeah.
But apart from that, not really.
And what was going on, like, when you pick the ball up and you do, you know, you find that gap where there doesn't look like there's a gap or something, you make something happen. Like, how did you access that level of performance for yourself?
I think it comes from my competitive side. So every action felt like a competition for me. So high ball, perfect skill situation for me because I was ultra competitive. So for me to win that ball, and I say this to anyone who I try and help with their high ball, it's all about being the most competitive you are to get into that space between yourselves and the ball. And whoever does that will ultimately catch it. It's less about technique, really. Yeah. That kind of comes later. But if you're so aggressive and competitive and decisive into getting into that space before that and more than that other guy, you will catch the ball, ultimately come down with the ball.
So who wants it more?
Who wants it more, yeah. Again, taking someone on. So even if they tackled me, I'm thinking, I'm not going to die with the ball here because I've lost the competition. So you fight, kick. So I was good at kicking out of contact just because it felt like competition. If he brought me down, I've lost. Or, you know, I would want people to break the line in games because I'd want to have that competition of that one-on-one where really you should get beaten or stepped every time with that much space either side of you on the pitch as a fullback. But it was that competition to think, right, I'm gonna get you. You should go around me, but I'm gonna bring you down. And then not only am I gonna bring you down, I'm gonna go over, steal that ball and get it back from my teammates. And then I won the competition. So I think it was always that. And as a fullback, I was very different. I would love the physical, competitive competition in a ruck and get over the ball and do the sort of things that fullbacks weren't supposed to do. That's probably why I'm going back to the Marmite player. I'm doing stuff that fullbacks aren't really supposed to do. You get your head in. You know, I've got cauliflower ears, shaved head, a bit too aggressive as a fullback should be. You see that in the forwards, really, maybe centres. But I would love that competition and that having to fight to win that competition. So probably just comes down to that, really. Because I'm not the most physically gifted or technically gifted, I wouldn't say, but just ultra competitive in a rugby sense. And those actions, I think.
Funny how many people I've spoken to are professional at the top of the level or top of whatever it is, you know, elite level in their sport or chosen field who have all said it was a choice, basically, deciding I'm going to make it. And it's the same you're talking about on the micro there, but like per run with the ball or per catch or whatever that the micro is, but also on the macro, it's like just making that decision that you're going to do it.
I had that start of my career. So when I first got offered my professional contract with Quins, that was the moment I literally was like, well, I've got this opportunity. I'm not very good at anything else. So I've got to go and make it. So how am I going to do that? I'm not most physically gifted. I'm not most technically gifted. So it's all those little things, being competitive, but being most physical, working the hardest on certain things, being the first and last in training, all those things you always hear. But doing all that to make the most of that, this opportunity I've been given, because I shouldn't really have had this opportunity. I haven't gone through a rugby playing school like all these other guys I'm joining up the academy with, like Chris Walshaw and Millfield, people like that. And again, I'm not physically gifted or technically gifted as these other guys. So how am I going to make the most of this opportunity? Because I want to be a professional rugby player, because I'm pretty shit at everything else. So yeah, I had that moment when I got offered this contract, basically.
When did you realise that you were good enough to make it pro?
Probably when I got offered the contract. I don't know if I ever thought I was before then, or if I could. No, I think it was probably that day that, and I don't think I sat there and went, oh, I'm good enough to do it. I just thought, I'm going to do it.
Right.
I have to do it, basically.
Burn the boats, like there's no other option.
Yeah, I'm going to do everything I can to make it happen, so at least I have no regrets. Because I'm pretty shit at everything else, so I better make it work.
Too hard on yourself, mate. Too hard on yourself. What did life look like for you then? Like, obviously, with your parents and stuff. Was your dad shuttling you around to rugby training or at school?
So it would be... so he'd be shutting me around. But so bearing in mind, so my pathway is a bit different. So I went to sixth form college in Winchester. So I lived in Salisbury, but I went to sixth form college in Winchester, which is about half an hour, 40 minute drive. And I went there because it was a good rugby team for sixth form college. I think because of the area, they get a lot of those not state school, but the other one. The fee paying schools,
private schools,
yeah, like private schools go, yeah, like drop out there and go to the normal college, so they go there. I think it's just luck of the area. So joined there, and a couple of guys that were there were going to Harlequins on a Tuesday and Thursday night, because back then they had Tuesday and Thursday night training where anyone could go, so hundreds of boys would go, and then they would pick an under 19s and 21s teams with their academy players, and then filling the gaps basically with guys like myself that would come in on a Tuesday and Thursday night to make those teams up, because they only had like 10 of each age group of a full-time academy. So I followed them, went with them, and they would drive me from Winchester to Aldershot. So that was about an hour after college. We'd do that, which was good fun actually, because they were a year older than me as well. So they looked after me. But we turn up, there was hundreds of boys there, like there was loads of people on a Tuesday, and then they kind of filter it down to Thursday being the main teams that they'd picked. And then you play on a Saturday. So I went there with them, I did all right, but I was playing fly half then. I went playing number 10. So, cause I wanted to be the kind of main man. It's like a striker in football. Everyone wants to be a striker, don't they? Score the goals, be the main man. So it's the same there. I did like half a season, I think, but then back at college, my coach, who was Joe Marchant's dad, actually, he moved me to fullback. I was fuming, absolutely fuming. But he could see the skills in me, I think, which obviously worked out well. But I was fuming. I wanted to be the main man. He pulled me. I was fuming. But then the more I did it, I more enjoyed it. So then about half season in, I wasn't getting anywhere at Quinn's. Maybe a couple of bench spots. Moved to fullback, told them. They started playing at fullback and it worked out well. So played 19s, played 21s, then got called up for their second team, which was their full-time first team squad players, some of their academy players to play like in the A-League. And they needed someone as a fullback. Because I played by 21s, I got a call from the academy guy, academy manager, Colin Osborne. Can you play in this game on Monday night? I'm like, absolutely. Of course I will. It was against Gloucester away. And I thought I'd just be on the bench. Like they needed a spare player. So I turned up, walked in the change room, and I'd been visiting a uni at Worcester with my dad. So then he drove me to Gloucester, went to Worcester, spoke to them, and it was like a rugby program / academy program thing with Worcester. Not full-time academy, but just like a link. Spoke to them, then drove to Gloucester, played in that. But when I turned up, walked into the change room, and I went and sat with the bench spots because I thought I'd be playing there. All the other guys walked in, and one of the academy guys I played in the 21s seems like, oh, why are you sat there? I was like, oh, I'm on the bench. I'm like, I don't really know. And he's like, no, you're starting, mate. You need to go over there. I was like, oh, shit. Basically, I was like, oh, wow. What am I, like, panicking? Because, you know, this is a big level for me, like proper men, you know, full-time players. But I did all right. Did all right. Scored a try and then played the rest of that season in the second team as well and got a contract off the back of it. So, yeah, it just works out well.
Amazing, mate.
Yeah.
So absolutely love that.
I think we were talking about my dad driving me around, weren't we?
So he
used to drive me to... He used to come and pick me up after I'd finished training on Tuesday and Thursday nights at Quinn's. So the lads would drive me up because I wasn't driving at that point. And then he would then come and pick me up from somewhere near Southampton because they lived there. So it was a long night. So I'd be getting picked up at like 10, 11 at night and then drive me home. And then he'd pick me up from college games, come and watch those as well, which was Winchester, middle of the week. Then he'd come on the weekends to watch me for the 1921s. So, you know, three or four times a week, he's driving, you know, a few hours, just driving around. You know, early on in my rugby playing kind of career as a grassroots player, he's driving me to training. He ends up being one of the coaches. So he's coming to training, coming to games every week. But also as well, to be fair, I was very lucky that my dad introduced me to loads of different sports, which I think helped my rugby ultimately. He didn't push me to do it. He would just make sure I had the opportunity to try it, at least if I didn't like it. Like cricket, I tried, it was all right. Didn't carry on going, but he took me there. He'd take his time up to do that. So, you know, owe him for doing that. Because you can learn a lot from doing loads of different sports that'll help you ultimately where you want to fall. So,
were you one of the ones who, like the boomers off the back of the 2003 World Cup final? Is that how you got into it? Or you already
No, so
it?
I was already into it then. So 2004... So my age was when I got my full-time contract. So I would have been 17 in 2004. So what, 16?
Yeah. How old are you now?
I'm 37.
37, right.
Yeah.
And what was because you've gone on, mate, and had an incredible career. Like if you think that moment from getting pro contract, right? Second team at Quinn's.
Yeah.
To what you've done is outstanding. Like if you can reflect on the incredible career that you've had. Difficult question and probably one that you get all the time, but what's been the best moment for you, highlight moment for you?
There's probably three, I think, in the teams I played with. I think one would be the Prem 2012 win with Quinn's. First time Quinn's won the Premiership. The group of men and staff that we had were really tight. Great enjoyment, you know. Connor O'Shea created an amazing environment. We played a great brand. It was like this is our style, this is our identity. Whatever happens, we're gonna do that. And if you're good enough to beat us, then fair enough. But this is what we're gonna do. And it was enjoyable, but also it was a load of lads that I'd grown up with. Ugo Monier, George Robson, Chris Robshaw, Jordan Turnhall, Danny Kerr, all those guys you'd grown up with, had those good nights out early on. So we just loved it. We loved on the field because we were playing a great brand of rugby and we kind of had so much confidence in what was instilled in us of saying, you know, this is the way we're going to play. If you're good enough to try and beat us, see what happens. But then off it, so much enjoyment with what we did. So that one, and then the Grand Slam with England, 2016. I think firstly, off the back of that disappointing 2015 World Cup being dumped out, how hard that was to deal with the majority of those players, how we kind of bounced back to win that Grand Slam. And also, I think for me, growing up and from the age of five, watching the Five Nations back then, now the Six Nations, all that history, being a rugby supporter since then, and watching those games to be added to that history, I think, with that team, you know, is amazing for me. And then individually, I think, being able to run out with my son at the stoop for my, I think it was my 300th Quinn's game. Because when he was born, like I always wanted to do that, to a packed out stadium, and it was packed out. It was Sarri's at home. We didn't win, but I won't tell him that. It was packed out. It was Friday night. It was always something special about a Friday night at the stoop, under the lights against Sarri's. Got to do that with him. Also, Danny ran out for his 250th as well, so you get to share that moment with him and he ran out with his son. So yeah, got to do that, which is amazing.
Oh mate, what an incredible career, man. Honestly, it's been a real pleasure chatting.
I appreciate it.
We've gone over we've not talked about any of the things that I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I didn't get my transition and stuff in there.
We talked about lots more.
Yeah.
I'd love to have you on again, mate. Would you come on again next year?
100%, yeah. 100%.
I'm actually having a performance center built in my garage. It's like a big garage. But yeeah, I'll have my study and my podcast studio and gym and sauna and ice bath and everything in there.
Yeah, nice.
So, mate,
I'll go in the sauna, maybe not the ice bath.
Oh, you'll go in the ice bath, mate. I'll help you do it. It's easy once you've primed, it's easy. But yeah, mate, I'd love to have you there. I'd love to have you there and talk all about like the latter part of your career, like the year at Newcastle, what happened after that and all this transition. Could you study in at the minute a master's in, what's the actual title of the course?
Yeah, so it's a master's in sport and directorship. So it will help me apply what I've learned as an athlete in my rugby career into an off-field role, because that's where I want to go. My transition is to, I guess, like a leadership role in elite sport. Mm-hmm. So initially, I think it was to probably stay in rugby, but now over the last 9 months, I've been looking across all sports and the opportunities there. You know, someone like Ben Ryan in football at Brentford, leading that high-performance side there is really interesting to me, because that's what I'm interested in, high-performance. You know, that sporting director roles, general manager, they call it in America, which Quinns have that model with Billy Millard. So that's what I'm working towards. It's been tough and challenging, but also confirmation of where I want to go. Amazing to connect with so many people that are on the course, that are in roles in sport, but also other industries as well, who have lived experiences which I can learn off, is like gold dust. It's been great.
Yeah. Oh, amazing, man. I'm excited to see where you go. You'll have to come to me. We'll talk all about that stuff.
Yeah,
maybe it'll be better then, because you'll have had another like 6 months behind you on the journey. Are you still actively looking for a club now or not?
Yeah. So I'm in a weird grey area where I can still play mentally and physically. I think my name's still out there to play. But the playing option would have to align with what my family want to do. You know, Newcastle felt, you know, worlds away from down here. It felt like being abroad up there. So, it has to align with what they want to do and moving them around. My son's just started school, so that's important as well, take into account. Has to align with the work I've done with my transition so far, because, you know, I'm making good headway with that. And I wouldn't want to, say, for example, Japan, it'd be tough going there, because moving the family there, the work with my transition, I can't continue that. It's tough doing uni over Zoom, meeting people, getting into environments and learning that way. But also it'd have to align with what I want enjoyment wise as a player. So it had to be a clear playing identity that fits to what I get enjoyment out of. And being an ex-Quinn, it's very clear what, you know, playing identity I would enjoy. So, you know, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, brilliant, mate. All right, well, yeah, we can all hear about all those updates and what happens in between. We'll do the last three quick fire, because what I'll probably do is split this into two episodes, which would be nice. We get a really nice balance of the whole story. So the last three questions, we do the same. You've heard them from when you listen to it yourself. But the first one is, what's one thing that's either come up or you've discovered recently that you're particularly excited about?
So hard when you get put on the spot, isn't it? What I'm excited about, I think, to be honest, it's like, for me, in the position I'm in, it's just how much potential and opportunity there is out there for me to grow, learn, develop. I feel like I'm in a very learning and development phase in my life with my transition. What I've learned so far, how much there still is out there, how much growth I can make into a role, hopefully, that I want to get into. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the exciting thing for me, selfishly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's what I'm getting excitement out of at the moment, you know, meeting all these people that I've been lucky enough to meet, the environments I'm lucky enough to be in, the learning I'm doing on my uni, but with people like Craig White and other people that I'm lucky enough to meet, the events I'm getting invited to learn again, and then being able to apply that is the next thing. I'm desperate to get my teeth into somewhere to do that. But that's the exciting thing. But also on the flip side, because sometimes I can be a glass half full, half empty person, is then it's also nerve wracking because I can't see the end. You know, you can't see the where it's going sometimes, and you don't have that end goal because it's so broad. And the uncertainty of what the future is quite nerve wracking as well. So there's two sides to it, really.
Yeah, I hear you, mate. I hear you. I really relate to what you're saying at the beginning, though. Like, that's why I love Mondays because it's the new week. I love January because it's a new year. I like new chapters. They're so exciting about the potential. But you're right. If it's too broad, it can be a bit
over. Yeah, I just need to focus on that. Like you're saying, the new potentials. Just keep going back to that. Focus on that. It's okay for me at the moment to be broad, I think, because I think you have to be on your transition because you don't know where it's going to go because I've been so engrossed in one thing for so long. So,
mate, you got an incredible future ahead of you. I can see just from your mindset, your discipline, the way that you operate. Like, I'm really excited to see where you go.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
One habit that you would encourage your listeners to undertake?
Again, something I've learned very recently, getting out of your comfort zone as much as possible. I think coming from being a professional sportsman, come so engrossed, or I did, so insular, so focused on the next thing I need to do to be as good as I can be as a professional. You know, the next recovery thing, the next review, the next bit of feedback, the next game. And it just keeps going like that sort of hamster wheel that people talk about, that I think I forgot to get out of my comfort zone to help my development, which is what I'm doing loads at the moment. And it's exhausting. Things like, and people that listen that would know me, and I've spoken about it being an introvert, I hate presentations, hate it. Like, I get so nervous, like the fear. But doing that, so I've got one on Thursday, but I've only ever done like two. My first interview about a month ago had a presentation element in it, and I was so scared, but I got through it. Before that, it was my first uni assignment, had a presentation in it. I've got another one. So doing things like that, just forcing myself to do it. Because the first thing I think of when someone says, come and do a presentation, is how am I going to get out of this? You know, going to meet new people, getting out of my comfort zone. Anything I'm doing that is great, been great for my development. So just constantly trying to do that. I think I would say to someone, don't forget about getting out of comfort zone because it's massive for development.
Yeah, amazing, mate. I love that one. Last one is, if you take yourself back to a particularly challenging time, we've spoken about tons today already, like pick one. Imagine there's two versions of yourself. There's the one who's sat opposite me now, who's had the incredible career that you've had, and there's one who wouldn't have gone on to do those things. What's the key separator between the two Mikes?
I think the first one is being resilient, so finding a way. We talk about it a lot in elite sport, find a way to get it done. There's going to be days where you don't want to do something. There's going to be days where you have no motivation, or you feel down, or you feel ill, or you can't be bothered. Just find a way to get up, take that next step, or do that next thing. And then you'll get through it, and you think of the next step, and then the next step. And you don't always have to be PBing or doing amazing things that day. As long as you get something done, I think that's the difference. Because so relating it to being a sportsman, there's loads of days you can't be bothered, but if you want to be successful, you have to get stuff done. You have to just find a way to get it done. But then there'll be days you feel amazing, you go and PB and smash that day. What else? I think that's the main thing, just resilience.
I love that though, find a way.
Yeah, just finding a way. That's the difference, I think, between successful, being successful and not successful. And I would say the generation now probably aren't resilient enough, and it should be taught in schools, I think.
Mate, I hear that. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Mate, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, mate. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me. It's been good.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
You have reached your destination.
Hey, it's Mark Whittle.
Thanks so much for watching or listening. It's so great to have you a part of the Take Flight movement. Subscribe to the podcast on all platforms, video and audio, to be the first to see new episodes and new conversations with the greatest minds in the world. Follow me at MarkWhittle_TF on all social platforms. And visit takeflightworld.com to join our growing community of hustlers, performers, and go-getters. I can't wait to see you next time. Until then, stay positive, stay motivated, and of course, take flight.